WNYC is supported by Freelancers Insurance Company, a social purpose insurance company providing group rate health plans to members of Freelancers Union. More information is available at freelancersunion.org.
Hi, this is Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC On Demand. Podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads available when you want to listen at WNYC.org and iTunes. So far, the 2012 baseball season must look pretty good to R.A. Dickey. He's undefeated as a starter for the New York Mets. He's batting 500. And his new, quite personally revealing memoir has been getting great reviews. Wherever I wind up, my quest for truth, authenticity, and the perfect knuckleball was written with the help of Wayne Coffey of the New York Daily News. It's published by Blue Rider Press, and I'm very pleased that it has brought R.A. Dickey to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Now, the Mets play the Washington Nationals tonight. When are you expected at the ballpark?
I'm supposed to be there about 3 o'clock today.
So we're going to have to rush you out of here. You've called your book Wherever I Wind Up, but since you've spent so much of your time in the minor leagues, I suspect you're relieved that you finally wound up in the majors.
Certainly. And with the New York Mets, nonetheless, I think it's been a very metaphorical journey for me, and to end up with the New York Mets feels just right.
Well, you've been with the Mets since 2002, and although the team was already on a downward spiral when you arrived, in mid-August of that year, you flirted with pitching a no-hitter against the Phillies. You lost it on a bloop single by Cole Hamels.
Yeah, by the pitcher nonetheless, which just really is a dagger. But, you know, it's a well-pitched game, and anytime you throw a one-hitter, it's hard to be disappointed.
Yeah, well, we almost had a no-hitter yesterday, although that ends in the seventh inning. There are a lot of no-hitters into the seventh inning in baseball.
Yeah, those last three innings are the toughest innings. When you got a no-hitter going, and I had one last year going after six innings against the Phillies again, and that fourth time that you face the lineup, it's a tough time.
Is it because you're tiring or because they're starting to recognize the pitches and get more comfortable with letting the bad ones go by?
Well, for me, because the knuckleball isn't necessarily a pitch that fatigues you. It's much more the latter. Guys at that level are very, very good. They make good in-game adjustments. And in that case, it was just a matter of them figuring it out.
Well, despite the Mets losing record, did you feel that 2010 was a good season for you? I always wonder about I mean, ballplayers will always say, it's all about the team winning
sure.
and all of that. But you'd had a rough road getting there. I suspect you felt pretty good about yourself.
Well, there is a sense of satisfaction that I can hold well, having given my team a chance to win the majority of the time that I went out there to perform. Certainly, we didn't end up where we wanted to as a team, but anytime you can throw 200-plus innings and keep your team in the game for the majority of those innings, you feel like it's a satisfying year for you personally.
Does playing on a losing ball club that most of the experts predict won't make the playoffs again get a bit depressing?
Well, in New York in particular, there's such a huge media market that you can't help but have some of that permeate into the clubhouse. But, you know, we have dealt with that for a long time, and we have our own set of expectations as a team inside the culture of the clubhouse that should enable us to supersede what most people expect of us.
And some players don't want to even play in New York.
That's true.
How different is it than playing in Seattle or Minnesota?
It's just, I mean, it's the grandest stage in the game. You know, on any given day, there'll be 15 or 16 reporters in the clubhouse, where in Seattle or Minnesota or Texas, where I played before, there might be three or mm-hmm. four. So everybody's looking for an angle and for a story and to break something big. And if you can perform in New York, well, you should be able to perform anywhere, that's for sure.
I remember that song.
That's right.
How many years did you spend playing in the minor leagues?
Well, this is my 15th year, and I only have 7 years, complete 7 years in the big league. So I've spent about parts of 10 seasons, but eight full seasons in the minor leagues.
And that's despite the fact that you were a first-round draft pick, 18th overall? Is it different in baseball? In football or basketball, if you're a high draft pick, someone's guaranteed a team will stick with you a lot longer than they will with somebody else who is a borderline player, but who was drafted in a later round.
Certainly, certainly. In baseball, it's very unique in that every big league club has four or five or sometimes even six minor league affiliates. Each have 20 or 25 players on them. So there's about 160 players competing for 25 spots in every organization. So it's a very competitive game, and there are no guarantees once you sign that contract.
You open your book with an account of your first start in the majors, and you were with the Texas Rangers. It doesn't went too well against the Tigers.
No, not indeed. 2006 was my first start in the big leagues as
How old were you at the
full-time
time?
Knuckleballer. At that time, in 2006, I was 31 years old.
So you were already really trying to develop a new career at an age when a lot of ball players are already thinking of quitting.
Yeah, I was trying to reinvent myself. You know, the knuckleball is a pitch born of desperation, and my conventional stuff just wasn't getting it done. So if I wanted to keep chasing the dream of being a big leaguer, I had to turn to something I felt like gave me a chance, and the knuckleball did that.
Well, their knuckleball pitchers have tended to be older in many cases, or have been able to go on longer. You even say that you were convinced to try it by the number of wins logged by knuckleballers who were over 30 years old. Phil Niekro and Charlie Huff weren't, you say, weren't far from pitching with their AARP cards in their pockets. But I was the pitcher. I don't know how much you know about Hoyt Wilhelm. He was 15 days short of his 50th birthday when he finally stopped playing.
Yes, you know, I think that's one of the things that's very compelling about the pitch, especially for someone who wants to throw it, is that most of the time, you know, Charlie Huff told me the first time I ever met him, it took me one day to learn how to throw a knuckleball and a lifetime to throw it for strikes. So although it's a very capricious pitch and it's tough to predict, it surely can offer you a very long career if you can get to the place where you're comfortable throwing it.
But why do some players do better with it than others? Is it the way your hand can grip the ball?
Certainly, I think that has something to do with it. But I, you know, I think on a deeper level, it takes a certain type of human being to be able to hold the ups and downs that the knuckleball is going to bring. The knuckleball is such a chaotic pitch that when it's ugly, it can be very, very ugly.
And you talked about having a bit of a problem with it the other day, when although you won the game, but you finally threw in a fastball, and that's what lost you the shutout because you were having problems controlling the knuckle.
Yeah, you know, there's certain conditions that exist: cold weather, high winds, things that will take the humidity out of the air. Are tough conditions to pitch in for a knuckleballer. Fortunately, as the summer grows, you don't have many of those nights, but especially early on when the temperatures seem to be cooler, and here in New York, the winds, especially over there in Flushing, the winds howl pretty often, and that was the case on Saturday for me. Is that we were having some pretty high winds. It was tough to get a good grip, a consistent grip on the baseball.
And then the knuckleball comes in kind of like a butterfly,
yeah.
And any wind might throw it off course, even though you threw it perfectly.
Yeah, that's right. You know, you can throw a perfect knuckleball, and you know, if you have a different wind than you're used to, it'll push it right out of the strike zone. So there's a lot of in-game adjustments that have to take place in order for you to be consistent.
Now, I mentioned that your first start in the majors was with the Texas Rangers against the Tigers. You had been originally drafted by the Tigers. Was there some irony in the fact that they really
perhaps
gave you a big beating that night?
Well, you know, when I started in 2006, in the opening chapters of the book, you know, I talk about giving up six home runs and tying a modern day major league record for most home runs given up in a game. You know, I really didn't think of it then as being an irony of any kind. I was just trying to escape the pain of what it was like to be so disappointed. But certainly from there, I got better and better as my years rolled on.
Well, I would assume that a first major league start is rough for anybody. They even say the first game of the season is rough for veteran pitchers. You're really fired up, aren't you?
Yeah,
does that
you
make
are.
It rougher to throw a knuckleball?
Yeah, your adrenaline, you have to be able to kind of settle yourself, certainly. I think the thing about a knuckleball is that, you know, it takes the right kind of manager that really believes in you, because you're going to get a quicker hook. You're not going to get the benefit of the doubt for the most part because of the type of pitch that it is.
And catchers hate you.
Yeah, you know, Bob Uecker had a great statement. He said the best way to catch a knuckleball is to wait till it stopped rolling and go pick it up. So my catchers are a little bit better than that, thankfully.
Right now you're the only knuckleballer in the majors because Tim Wakefield retired.
He did. He retired. It's gotten lonely.
So after that poor performance against the Tigers, did you think that that would be the end of your shot in the majors?
Well, you never know. I got sent down the very next day, so I got the one shot at trying to make it work, and then it was off to the minor leagues. Fortunately, over the course of that year, I learned quite a bit in the minor leagues and felt like I still had something to offer. You know, I was still passionate about the pitch, and I still loved coming to work and learning more about it. So from then on, I just was really committed at trying to get it right.
My guest is R.A. Dickey. He's written with the help of Wayne Coffey of the New York Daily News, Wherever I Wind Up, obviously a wordplay, My Quest for Truth, Authenticity, and the Perfect Knuckleball. We've been talking about baseball, but you tell your life story here as well. You grew up in a divided house. Your parents were divorced, and even when you would stay with one of them, it doesn't seem like it was particularly comfortable. Your dad's apartment didn't even have a kitchen?
Well, we had a hot plate. I think that might count. But we, when my parents were divorced early on, my sister and I would go visit my father on a little one-bedroom efficiency on Sunset Boulevard in Nashville, Tennessee, and he would cook us macaroni and cheese on the hot plate.
And that was it. So you ate macaroni and cheese whenever you were with Dad? You say your mother's drink of choice was Miller Lite, although eventually she switched to vodka. Do you think she was always an alcoholic?
Well, I think that's part of her story. You know, we all have a story. Part of her story and her family of origin, I think, comes from a place of alcoholism, and I talk about that some in the book. But
your grandfather was also.
Right, and my grandmother for a while. They both were pretty good drinkers, and they grew up in that environment. So that was the thing that my mom turned to.
On the other hand, your grandfather also influenced your love of sports.
Certainly.
And bought you your first serious baseball glove?
Yeah, he did. And he always was after me to be the best, even though, you know, he might have had his own baggage. He certainly poured into me a lot. You know, and I got the best parts of my grandfather because he had become sober late in his life. And he would tell me about he was the first person that taught me about the knuckleball. He once struck out 16 guys in a game with a knuckleball, and he was always trying to push it on me, you know. And I had a big arm then. Back then, I was drafted in the 10th round out of high school as a fastball pitcher, and I never really needed a knuckleball, but he was always trying to push the knuckleball on me. So that is a neat irony.
Well, it would have been great to have been able to throw the ball 95 miles an hour and then follow it with a knuckleball.
Yeah, it would.
Most knuckleballers can't get into the 80s.
That's right.
One of the so did you always want to be a pitcher?
I always wanted to be a competitor. I didn't really care at what. You know, I played football and basketball in high school and felt like I could have probably played some football in college. I just liked to compete. There was something that has always drawn me to competition, and you know, I kind of settled as a pitcher because that was the place where I felt I had the most control. You know, the game doesn't start until I throw the ball.
Well, was control important to you because of your personal history?
Yeah, it was. You know, when you grow up being the victim of sexual abuse and kind of bouncing from house to house, you don't really have much control over anything. You don't trust anything. And so I would always gravitate towards things that I could control myself. Sports was one of them. I poured myself into sports in a way that helped me escape the pain of the things that I was hiding.
First sexually abused by a female babysitter, later by a 17-year-old boy. Did you feel like you had a target on your back?
Well, you know, I don't know about a target. I certainly think that I didn't have the capacity to be able to process any of it at that age. I was only 8 years old and scared to death, really. So you do what you do to survive in those moments, and that's usually to stuff things deep down and not let people know about them. And there's something about those kind of experiences that you feel like were your fault. You can't really replace it, but you feel like you've participated in something very wicked, and that in some way it's your fault, so you feel less than human. And you feel like if you communicate that to somebody, they're going to want to turn their back and run the other way. Of course, that's a lie that's perpetrated, as a kid, and that's what keeps people from talking about it. And that's one of the hopes of the book, is that people will read it and want to talk about it.
Well, including your own wife. You didn't tell her until I imagine you decided to reveal it in the book?
No. Well, I told her before the book started, but we had been married 9 years before I even told my own wife. And she wasn't even the first person I told. I mean, I really did a lot of work with a professional and trying to unpack my story. And he was the first guy that I ever risked that with.
Now, the pitcher, you say you can control things, but then you decide to throw a pitch that is the hardest pitch in the world to control. So you're always playing on the edge, aren't you?
I am walking on a razor's edge, it would seem. You know, the knuckleball is the ugly stepchild of all pitches, probably, you know, because it can be so beautiful in one moment and so ugly in the next. But, you know, I talk about the knuckleball as if I have a relationship with it. You know, it's been something that's been very artistic in my life. You know, I've always been pulled to the written word and to art, and this to me is part of that. Knuckleballing is an art for me.
Well, getting back to the babysitter, she abused you a number of times, even once when your mother was in the next room. So did you just feel this was going to be the way things... You met her years later, you say.
Mm-hmm.
And you confronted her, and what was her response?
Well, you know, and that was probably one of the most painful things that I remember was the fact that she acted like nothing had ever happened. That plays all kinds of psychological tricks on you, because you feel like, did that really even happen to me? Did I conjure that up somehow? It plays all kinds of dirty tricks on you. So that was her response, and so I was kind of left to wonder and kind of walk in limbo there for a long time. But it wasn't really until the summer or the fall of 2006, when I got to the end of myself, that I really started to confront some of the demons of the past.
And what was the reaction of family and friends?
Well, so far, you know, I think my biggest fear in it has always been that I would be who I was, and that would be in some way ugly to people. And my experience has been antithetical to that. My wife, Anne, I have revealed the ugliest things about myself, and she's embraced me despite that.
Well, she's been with you a long time, hasn't she? Not long after your abuse is when you met her in school?
Yeah.
How old were you?
I was 13 years old, a seventh grader in an all-boys school in Nashville, Tennessee, when I went home one afternoon with her brother and happened to meet her as she was doing her homework on the couch.
Now, a lot of marriages of this sort have problems.
Sure.
You're out traveling all the time. Is there something special about this relationship?
Oh, yeah. You know, Ann and I, you know, and I've done a lot to harm her through keeping all kinds of, and I talk about this in depth in the book, but, you know, any time that you hide who you are and you project something other than who you really are, it does a lot of damage.
Because you know you're always lying on some level.
You're building a relationship based on the precept of a lie. And I did that for years and years. I'd gotten very good at it because of what I felt like I had to do to survive.
Now, you've written this book, which includes some other interesting details, like the fact that you once found a syringe in the bathroom floor of the Rangers locker room, although you say you never saw anybody take steroids. When Jim Bouton, another mm-hmm. knuckleballer, by the way, wrote a book in which he talked about what happened in the clubhouse, he became a kind of a pariah in baseball. Are you concerned?
I think that was one of my fears initially, was what would be the response of in the culture of the clubhouse. Thankfully, I've felt like I've kind of come up in an era of baseball recently within the last 5 years where people are maybe a little less judgmental on really attacking people based on who they are. And so I've been met with an outpouring of encouragement.
Well, you're not about to tell us that Mickey Mantle wasn't the hero we thought
right.
he was when we were kids.
That's right.
You tell a number of other things that you had to overcome. For example, battling the Missouri River.
Oh, dear. Yeah. That was, you know, there's something that's always, I felt drawn to risk-taking for whatever reason, and that was a risk that almost cost me my life, literally. But thankfully, I survived it. And
you almost drowned?
Yeah, almost drowned a couple of different times trying to get across, which I never did. I got about halfway out and had to turn around, and it was on the way back that I almost drowned.
But you seem to think that experience changed your ability on the field.
Well, it certainly made things more rich. It from that moment on, I felt a real compulsion to be captivated by the moment, and that translated directly into my pitching. You know, I wanted to make the most of every single pitch. You know, instead of thinking three or four batters out, I was engrossed in trying to throw a perfect knuckleball 110 times a game over the course of a start.
But before that, when you first signed, you represented the United States in the 1996 Olympics, were featured on the cover of Baseball America alongside with your teammates, and that picture actually almost cost you your career. It revealed something about you physically?
Yes, I underwent a physical after signing as a first-rounder with the Rangers, and they discovered that I didn't have the existence of an ulnar collateral ligament in my right elbow, which is the Tommy John ligament, or the ligament that a lot of pitchers have to have replaced when it tears.
But you didn't even have it.
I did not have it.
You were born without it?
There's two schools of thought out there. One school says I ripped it when I was very young, and my body compensated above and below the injury to allow me to throw, and another school thinks that I was born without it.
But is that why you think you had to develop a knuckleball to maintain your career? Because in the end, you had a physical disadvantage here.
Well, perhaps that played into it. In 2005, when I was confronted with the reality that my conventional stuff wasn't going to get it done. I mean, I was throwing 85, 86 miles an hour, which wasn't going to cut it at the big league level. Because I didn't have that ligament, that might have played a part.
Does an 85-mile-an-hour fastball look faster after somebody's seen a bunch of knuckleballs?
Yes. Now that 85, 86 can be kind of quick after a Prince Fielder's seen 8 or 9 or 10 knuckleballs in a row.
I wouldn't want to face Prince Fielder with anything. This past January, you climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, and the Mets were kind of surprised you didn't tell them?
Well, I told them. I think their surprise was that I decided that even though they had some resistance to it, that I went ahead and did it anyway, you know, because I could have risked the second part of my 2-year contract if I would have been hurt on the mountain. But we raised a lot of money for a fantastic charity, and it was a very worthwhile experience.
What does the charity do?
It's the Bombay Teen Challenge, and it rescues young girls and women from sex trafficking and human slavery in Mumbai, India, in the red light districts.
Mm-hmm. Now, you will be facing off against Cliff Lee of the Phillies in your next start on Friday. Mm-hmm. Is that a little scary?
I don't know if scary is the word. I think I'm definitely excited. Anytime you face one of the best guys in baseball, it's fun.
Now, we don't have much time, but a listener wants to know if you can explain how you throw a knuckleball. How does it differ from throwing a regular pitch?
Well, it requires sharp fingernails that you dig into the leather of the baseball right behind the horseshoe. The laces on the baseball form a horseshoe. And I take my two fingernails, my pointer finger and my middle finger, dig them into the laces of the baseball and try to keep my wrist as stiff as possible and try to release the ball at the opportune moment where it doesn't spin.
Now, and the opportune moment is the important. The point mm-hmm. of release is what determines ultimately whether a pitch is going to come over for a strike or a ball.
Correct.
That's why the same pitcher, even if he's throwing 100 miles an hour, can be wild on one pitch and throw the perfect pitch the next time.
Yes, the release point is probably the quintessential component of the pitching mechanic because if you have multiple release points, it's going to be hard to be consistent in a knuckleball. Requires a very consistent release point.
So I would assume that it's just a matter of practice and you wind up with the same release point every time.
Yeah, you know, I would throw hundreds of balls against a brick wall until I felt like I had the right mechanic right.
Now, you mentioned that you had a number of interests in sports. You also played in college with Peyton Manning and the Colorado Rockies first baseman Todd Helton. That must have been an exciting time.
Yeah, you know, I learned all kinds of things from those guys, and Peyton Manning in particular, on how to prepare and the things it takes.
Well, maybe it's the Colorado Rockies for you next.
Who knows?
R.A. Dickey will be giving a reading and signing books tomorrow at 11:30 at the Barnes & Noble Citicorp store at 160 East 54th Street, and then again on Sunday, April 22nd at 6 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble Fresh Meadows at Queens on Union Turnpike. The book, Wherever I Wind Up, My Quest for Truth, Authenticity, and the Perfect Knuckleball, is published by Blue Rider. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to WNYC On Demand. Please check out the other programs at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This is a free service made available by our listeners. Become a member of WNYC today.